There are people listening and willing to help.
We have to innovate.
Get informed. Contact your local CLSC, Sun Youth, Amy Quebec, Ford House, or Prevention Suicide.
Schemes. You can laugh till your dreams fall apart at the seams, and life gets more exciting with each passing day, and love is either in your heart or on its way. Don't you know that it's worth every treasure on earth when you're young? For it's hard, you will find, to be narrow of mind when you're young at heart. And if you should survive to 105, look at all you'll derive out of being alive. And here's the best part, you'll have a head start if you are among the very young at heart.
Good evening and welcome to Older Women Live on CKUT at 90.3 FM, feminist radio heard the second Wednesday of each month. Presently we're a collective of four older women who are digitally assisted by a fifth who is somewhat younger than we are and a lot more computer savvy. Without our dear tech, Courtney Kirkby, our voices will have faded away with the pandemic. So we thank Courtney for her love, for her patience and for her time. Today we have two interviews and some new music, new for us anyway, electronic, Canadian electronic music. Older Women Live Collective member Brisna Kajaro is from Guatemala and is working on the aftermath of the genocide in her country, which resulted in the murder of over 200,000 people, mostly Mayan, over a period of, well, it was from the 60s until 96. The problem with wars is that they're messy and they don't really end. There's the gruesome task of identifying all the bodies and bringing the perpetrators to justice. That's a huge task. A similar situation exists in Colombia, where a fragile peace sort of exists after almost 60 years of war. Brisna's interview concerns the role of women in the peace process and the difficulty that the women face. As we think about Remembrance Day, we might think about the aftermath of armed conflict. Both Guatemala and Colombia are cases of heartbreak and heroism, of loss that will ricochet into the future way into the future. The second interview is one I did with a friend, Claire, and it's on the topic of life before computers, the pre-digital age. As we spoke, we realised that there are fewer and fewer people who witnessed the arrival and takeover of the digital age. We figured that this happened in the early 80s. Again, it's complicated. Many groups of people are excluded from the fun and the frustration. We also have a little music for you. The first cut is from Colombia, and it's a group of women drummers, all of whom were victims of male violence. The second piece is by a Canadian composer, Rose Bolton, from Toronto, and it's a bit of electronic music. We're branching out. It's called Shoreditch Memory, and we hope you enjoy it. So sit back, and we hope you enjoy our show. My name is Rosemary Wally. So we've just been reminiscing, Claire, about life before the digital age. And we decided that the digital age started really in the late 80s, didn't it?
Yes, yes.
So what do you remember from before? What were some of the things?
Before the digital age?
Yeah.
I wrote a lot of letters. I wrote letters to my sisters, my friends, my mother. I wrote letters. And then occasionally we would make a phone call, but phone calls were very expensive.
Yeah, they were.
And so phone calls were limited, but it was mostly letters we'd write.
Yeah, and then there was the tremendous anticipation of receiving letters.
Yes.
I mean, all our early boyfriends were in the form of letters.
Yes, that is true. And then we also, and okay, with the letters, yes, and then also you would never make 100 texts in order to meet somebody for a coffee. You would tell them, I will meet you at the coffee shop at 2:30 p.m. on Tuesday, and that would be it, on a phone call. And then you would both arrive at 2:30 p.m. on a Tuesday without back and forth, back and forth.
Yeah, it sounds as though it was much simpler in a way, because those were reliable appointments.
They were reliable, and you would just make them, and you would expect your friend to be there. And it was simpler because you spent a lot of time going over a lot of different little things every day that really could be done in one if you were in that mindset.
That you
didn't need that you didn't need an additional 15 texts to firm up this date.
We never did. We never needed.
No, you never needed.
Because we didn't have phones.
No, you had to talk from your landline. So when you were going out with your girlfriends in high school, you would phone one of them, and I was even on a party line, so I had to wait till the line was free.
Let's explain what a party line is.
It's not much of a party. What it is that one line is connected with you and perhaps one or two or three neighbors, and so you'd pick up your receiver before you did anything, and you'd listen, and if somebody was speaking on it, you would hang up gently, and then you would wait and wait and keep picking it up until that line was free. And then you'd phone your girlfriend and you'd say, I'll pick you up at 8:30 and we'll go out. And that was it.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And of course, I remember even before that, I remember when you had to go to the corner, you know, because there were public phones everywhere at that time, right?
Yes, yes. There was public phones, and you would use them.
Absolutely.
You would have your, oh my gosh, what was it? A nickel? A dime? A dime, I think it was. Then it went up to a quarter. You'd have your dime handy, and you'd put your dime in, and you'd phone. And sometimes if you got smart, you could get your dime back somehow. Like you'd put it in, but the person wouldn't answer. You'd have a code, and it would ring twice, and you'd hang up, and that person knew they had to come pick you up, and you'd save that dime.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then, of course, we got the digital age, which gradually spread and spread, and now, of course, almost everybody's online.
Yes, but so here we are, the generation that grew up with phones and party lines and writing letters, and now we're having to cope in our older years with the digital age. And we have to cope with credit cards, cell phones, Wi-Fi, using data, and we have to do a lot of things on our phone and have our phone with us so that we can navigate through life now. And sometimes it's difficult. And I'm just, you know, I take public transit, and sometimes you're thinking, I just want to throw some coins in the box, but you don't know if you can, because that may not be how these transportation services work anymore.
Well, I know that here in Montreal, you cannot pay by cash. At least I don't think you can. Maybe you can pay by cash on a bus if you've got the exact change. But in general, what you have to do is you have to put money on your Opus card. And when you go to the metro station, and it says, Déposez votre carte Opus. So where do you put your Opus card? If you're not very good with technology, like I'm just a terrible disaster, you can't even see where to slot in your card.
Yeah.
And you have to have a certain mindset, which I don't have. Maybe our mindsets are more complicated because we didn't grow up with it.
No.
Do you think?
I think so. And also I'm thinking when you're getting up there and you're sitting there and you're looking at this machine and you're getting anxious. And so you're wondering, do I need to? Then you feel a little embarrassed. I feel a little embarrassed asking for help sometimes because, and plus everybody's in a hurry. Everybody's rushing by you. You can't stand in front of one of those machines and think about it and mutter through it because people are behind you. It's hard to cope with.
Well, it is. I mean, I used to be considered literate, but now gradually I can see that I'm getting less and less literate because I need help with more and more tasks. And the help that I need is banal help. It's do I push this button or that one or what? And it's a way of thinking that I clearly do not have.
No, I agree with you. Yes, because it's not something we're used to. No, and... It's difficult. And then even, just for example, I was in Montreal. I don't live in Montreal. I was in Montreal, and we were getting a bus to the airport, and we had to catch it on the street. And I read the website, and it said it cost $10 a person. And I must have missed the fine print, but I read it, $10 a person. I thought, fine, I'm great. I've got a $20 bill in my pocket. And we got on the bus. Well, no. You needed to have done it on your cell phone and then activated the ticket. And the bus driver just looked at me like I had two heads. He goes, no, you can't use cash. And I said, well, cash is all I have. And he said to me, he says, no, you have to go down. You have to go down. And he pointed to a terminal, and a terminus, like, and buy your tickets. We were going out to catch a plane, and I said, oh my gosh, I said, do we have time? We have to wait for the next bus then. So he was very generous, and he did drive his bus half a block, and we jumped out, and he said, make it fast, and we tried. Well, nothing, it wasn't working. And I'm thinking, well, is it us? My husband and I, is it us? So the bus driver, I think he'd given up at us now, he jumped out, and sure enough, the ticket dispenser was not working. So... we ended up riding for free. That was a happy ending to the story. But on the other hand, it was like, that was a lot of information. First of all, I had to go to the website. I had to read the website, obviously, more closely than I did. I would have had to buy a ticket using my credit card on my phone, activated that credit card, which requires data, and some people don't have data, activated that ticket before the bus got there, and then I would have been on my way. But it was... So that's a lot to manage.
Well, it is a lot to manage. And then you also have all these groups that it discriminates against anybody who doesn't have a card, a bank card. Now, that's a lot of poor people.
Yes.
They do not have these cards.
Yes.
And it discriminates against people that
don't have a phone. Don't have a smartphone.
That's right, a smartphone. We're talking about it discriminating against poor people.
Exactly.
Yeah, discriminates against poor people. And who else?
Yeah, if you don't have... But it also discriminates against people who are older. It discriminates against the elderly because they can't manage that. My mother lived to be 89, and she did not have a smartphone. And so she would not have been able to do any of this.
Exactly. It definitely discriminates against those of us who are, well, I'm almost 80, those of us who are, as you say, elderly, mm-hmm. who grew up before the digital age, definitely. So we've got the poor people, we've got the elderly, and then it very much discriminates against those people that are not literate, that cannot read and write. As a teacher, I was a literacy teacher, I know there are huge numbers of people that cannot figure these things out.
If they have a handful of coins and you know how much it costs, even if you don't know how much it costs and you've a handful of coins and got on a bus and held out your hand of coins, the bus driver would pick out what he needed and you would get that ride. But nowadays, you can't. You can't.
Yes.
Who's taking the bus?
Old people, mainly women.
And people of low income.
People of low income. And then, of course, we've got to talk about people who have got, you know, mental or physical issues in some way that are unable to figure this stuff out for different lots of reasons. So it heavily discriminates against many, many groups in our society.
It does, and more, and it's just getting everything is getting more and more digital, like more and more technology you need to do anything, I'm just trying to think.
You see, I think that another thing that it does is it doesn't respect people's right to a dignified life. I mean, you're standing there as though you're a 3-year-old, a 5-year-old. You know, you cannot do whatever is being asked of you.
That is true.
And you feel so humiliated.
That's what I said. And then you get anxious and the anxiety, and then you really can't help yourself because there's people behind you pushing and moving, and the world is just flying by you as you sit there and try and read and figure out what you're supposed to be doing. Yeah.
Now, these are sort of relatively, in some ways, they're not really terribly important issues, but what is extremely important, I think, is communicating between people. Does the digital age increase or decrease our ability to communicate, to have contact with our fellow humans?
I think it decreases, to be fair, it sometimes isolates people, but sometimes a younger generation of a family will set up an iPad or a computer for their elderly parents, and where they only have to press a few buttons, and then all of a sudden they're FaceTiming or Zooming with their grandchildren or their great-grandchildren. But once again, that's a privilege. That's people with privilege who are doing that, people who can afford an iPad or a laptop and things like that. So, but I think because another situation was my mother, who was 89, would go into the bank and go up to a teller instead of putting her money in the bank machine, depositing a check in the bank machine. And the teller once asked her, "Why, you know, you can deposit in the bank machine." And my mother said, "Yes, I know I can, but I'd really like chatting with you. I really like seeing you." And so for some older people, that's their only human contact, are people that are actually, like, and that's like in a grocery store now. You can check out your own groceries. So you would chat with the person who's checking out your groceries, or you should chat at the drugstore. But now they encourage you to use the self-checkouts. So you're wondering, so you think about this poor elderly person who maybe doesn't have anybody at home to speak to or doesn't have a lot of friends, and everywhere they go, they're met by a machine and not by a person.
Well, that brings us also to the whole question of jobs, doesn't it? Because these machines are taking away, replacing humans.
That is true. Not getting away from people doing the work as well.
Yeah, and I mean, it really, as you say, you know, there's the whole thing of the isolation. But then there's also, I mean, sometimes you can feel really, I don't know, you can feel totally despondent that you're talking to a machine or something.
Yes.
It seems to me in
some ways that we've got no intricate worth as human beings anymore.
Yes. Yeah, and then I think that the stress too on kids these days.
Yeah, let's talk about kids.
And everybody is expected to have a phone now, and everybody expected to and then the lives they portray on their phone are different from the lives they're living, and it's just to me it's just like exhausting for the kids to try and keep up with all this, and it's also exhausting for now business owners and entrepreneurs, because everything is done online and through media. So you have to keep up this whole, every day something has to be new, and every day you have to put something new out there, or people won't know your business, won't support your business. So everything moves so quickly, but I don't think anybody, you know, all the time you spend writing all this stuff, or even the kids putting pictures up, everything is a second. Everything is viewed in a second, and they just keep scrolling through, and hours can be spent doing that. But I know I've done, you know.
Hours. Oh, you mean this social media thing?
Yeah, social media. Hours can be spent, and then it's gone. And you've
yes.
talked to nobody. You've done nothing. You've not left your room. You've not left your chair. Yeah,
and I think there's also a real crisis, what you were just saying, of authenticity.
Oh, yeah.
You see, I mean, children, they've got their own character, but they can't develop it, right, because they're pretending to be or
somebody.
They think they have to be somebody else.
Yeah, yes, I agree. I totally agree. Yeah, it's just, and I don't know how we can, I somehow wonder how we can ever get out of this spinning world we're on, spinning social media we're on. Will it stop? Will we ever go back to where we're more authentic people and meeting and greeting people for who they are and not for their social media profiles? I feel badly for the young people of today, because you look at them and so much time is spent on their phones, you're thinking how much life they're missing out on. Like, how much just life. Yeah, I don't know. It's interesting. I do feel badly for them, though.
Is there any life on the digital platforms, you think? Or that's not real life?
Yeah. I don't think it's real life. No. Like, if you put up a photo, it's only a photo of something that's fantastic and beautiful, I think. But then on the other hand, people do record like their worst intimate moments. And then I'm thinking, well, that's also like, is that information that should be shared on a digital platform, on a worldwide platform? It's a very hard call. I think when you look at that, you have to decide, well, how you're going to live your life. And how you're going to hope your children or your grandchildren live their lives, and offer them other opportunities beside that digital world. But that's exhausting for parents.
And that's not what's happening.
That's exhausting for parents. And it's much easier to have your kids sitting, I think, on a phone.
I think that because children screens at a very early age, and these screens are extremely powerful
right.
in terms of attracting their attention. They don't want anything else. They just want to sit and watch these YouTube things or whatever it happens to be. And it's mainly pro-capitalist, pro-American, I don't want to say nonsense.
Well, yeah.
But it really is. I mean, I've been looking, for example, for good... I mean, this is going to sound crazy, but I've been looking, actually, for nature films to show the little kid I babysit. And the nature films, the only ones, are Walt Disney nature films, and they're horrible. They're not the old, you know, David Attenborough films of, I don't know, zebras or whatever. So there's very little. It looks as though there's tons and tons of stuff, but it's all variations on the same rather superficial theme.
But it also goes by, like, it goes by, they've been there for an hour, and you can ask them what they saw or watched, and it's, there's nothing concrete, nothing They don't learn anything from it. No. It's just empty time. And that's...
And I think the same is true for adults as well. We just sit there.
Oh, yeah.
You know, we just veg out in front of it.
Yeah. A lot more time looking at the screen than when I was growing up.
Well, we never really looked at the screen. We used to go to the movies.
I was more like we had a television. We always had a television, but we literally watched an hour a day, at maximum an hour a day. I think we only watched it on weekends, actually.
Probably.
Yeah. I just don't, like, it's just, you just feel like the world is whizzing by. That's the kind of feeling of the anxious anxiety of the world whizzing by, and you really, you can't keep up.
Well, the thing is that you can't keep up. But what you're trying to keep up to with is something that we didn't have when we were kids, and that's the utter superficiality of it. I mean, people are lost. There's total confusion, I think, at every level.
Yes, yeah. And also, then when you, like, even in the digital world, as far as news goes, I mean, the stuff that comes in and people believe that isn't real, and, like, that's a whole other story.
No, it's part of the same thing.
Yeah, people that, like, what people can put out there, it's almost the same as, like, I was saying nothing but nice pictures on Instagram. Well, people believe that, and the same with news or articles or thing. But you, like, who do you know to believe? Like, who... How do you know which is true? How do you know what to believe? Mm-hmm. Then what you have to do is read more articles, get more, and it's just a treadmill.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. Yeah. Thank you very much, Claire Kirkby, for a very interesting discussion.
Tonight, during our show, Older Women Live, OWLCKUT 90.3 FM, will talk about building peace, the role of women, and an example of a country going through the process of achieving peace, Colombia. Although Colombia did not have successive military dictatorships supported by the United States, its imperialist economic interest was expressed in supporting anti-communist regimes, the creation of death squads to eliminate and kidnap union leaders, social workers, etc., and especially in promoting an endless war against drug cartels. Political violence led to an internal armed conflict in Colombia that lasted 60 years. A stable and lasting peace agreements were signed between the government of Colombia and the FARC-EP guerrillas in 2016 in Bogotá. This latest agreement was ratified by the Colombian Senate and the House of Representatives at the end of the same year. In Colombia's civil war, 80% of the dead were civilians. The Truth Commission indicates that during the years that the armed conflict lasted, there were about 51,000 kidnappings, 122,000 disappearances, 451,000 murders, and 7.7 million displaced persons. The participation of the drug cartels complicated the internal armed conflict in this country. Drug trafficking is at the center of corruption and impunity in Colombia because of the power it has by subjugating military officials, police, judges, and politicians with money. Colombia produces 70% of the cocaine in the world. The president of the Truth Commission pointed out that a transformation of the fight against drug trafficking is urgent, and the solution is not armed war. Because an armed war against drug cartels only raises their profits, and military intervention is included for business purposes. Transitional justice is the way. Before any drug lord is extradited, he must deliver the truth in depth. Reparation must be demanded for the victims and the delivery of capital to the state, he concluded. In this context, the triumph of the historic pact coalition in recent presidential elections and the arrival to government of President Gustavo Petro Urrego and Vice President Francia Márquez Mina on August 7, 2022, brings much hope for the implementation of the stable and durable peace agreements. Petro Urrego is a political scientist and economist. Francia Márquez is a human rights, an environment activist and lawyer who became the first Afro-Colombian vice president in the country's history. In 2018, she was awarded the Goldman Environmental Prize for her work to stop illegal gold mining in her country of La Toma, in her community, of La Toma. The meeting of women peace builders in the Latin American movement was organized by the Women's Section of the United Nations organization last October in Colombia. One of the participants and presenters in this meeting, the president of the National Union of Women of Guatemala and coordinator of the gender program at Impunity Watch Guatemala, is with us tonight. Let's welcome Brisna Karina Cashaj Alvarez. Thank you so much for accepting our invitation to Older Women Live, OWL, CKUT, 90.3 FM. Brisna, could you please tell us briefly about you and your work?
As you mentioned, I'm currently president of the National Union of Guatemalan Women. This is a feminist women's organization that has been in Guatemala for more than 42 years. I've been a member of this organization for quite some time now, more than 20 years. And one of the main objectives of the organization, or one of the things that we're committed with, is the building of peace. Right after the signing of the peace in Guatemala, some of the members who had to go into exile returned to Guatemala to try to promote the building of the peace accords and the agreements, particularly linked to women's rights. So throughout this time, we've been really committed to peace building, but also to the implementation of resolutions on women, peace, and security from the Security Council, Resolution 1325 and others, but also in recognizing the leadership of women in the peace building process. And through my work at Impunity Watch, I've also been monitoring the implementation of these resolutions, obviously supporting cases of transitional justice, particularly cases of sexual violence or of crimes against women, which is also an important pillar when we were talking about peace building, the access to justice and the importance that there be no impunity for these crimes that occurred during the armed conflict.
Thank you very much, Brisna. That seems like a very important work that needs to be done in every society. We know that you recently went to Colombia to attend meetings. And so we would like to know, what are your impressions of what is going on in Colombia and the role of women in the construction of peace?
Well, first of all, I think my biggest impression is that right now there's a context of hope for change. I think that the conflict in Colombia has been too long and there are too many victims throughout this conflict. So there has been a longing for peace with the Colombian society. And I think that the latest peace agreements that were signed 5 years ago was really significant, because it meant having to build peace with one of the biggest armed groups in Colombia. However, there was a lot of sectors in society that felt that not all the actors were sitting at the table, were not being part of this discussion. And there's also been a context of recent increase in violence. This is what I learned from some of the women, that there are still other groups, and obviously organized crime is still present in some of the communities. So I also think that the election of the new government, with a new proposal and with a commitment to peace building, is also giving hope again to the population. And I saw a lot of excitement because there's new dialogues that are being started with different sectors. And from the meeting that I participated in, a lot of the women that were there were part of the peace dialogue, and they also shared their experience in terms of fighting for a space to be part of the peace dialogues. So I think that was a very important achievement on their part, that a lot of women were part of the discussion of the peace agreement and the signing of the accords in Havana, Cuba, were the most important ones for them in terms of women's participation and leadership at the table. And I was really impressed to see as well that there was women from different sectors. There was women who had been in the guerrilla. There were women in the military. There was also women at the community levels, women from indigenous communities. There's obviously challenges because there's different perspectives on what maybe peace means or what the process should be. But the common ground is that there is a commitment and the desire for peace building. And I think these women have shown extraordinary commitment and involvement in peace building at different levels, from their community levels to the national level. And I think it's also very hopeful that the vice president is a woman who's also comes from activist groups and from Afro-descendant groups, and also the involvement of women at different levels of government who understand how conflict affects women, but also their commitment to peace building.
Well, I have a question. And how many women in this new government, how many women are really in positions of power, or do you know a percentage, or if this government really gives, besides all you have said, but it gives more positions of power to women that are going to exercise it in not only building peace, but also increasing the respect of women's rights?
Well, from what I learned is that besides the vice president, who's a woman, at the ministry levels, out of 16 ministries, 8 of them are women. And at least 4 of them identify themselves as feminists. So at the meeting that I was at, the minister from labor was there. She's a woman, and she claims herself as a feminist. In the Ministry of the International Relations, is also a woman. In the Ministry of Culture, I think it was. At least there was three women that I was able to meet at this meeting, and they all showed commitment to peace building. They also shared some of their intentions of the changes that they want to make in terms of policies or programs that will be focused towards women's empowerment or women's involvement, and definitely this commitment to the peace dialogues and to the implementation of peace building.
Well, thank you very much for your answer. Now, what was your presentation about in this meeting?
I want to say that the meeting that I participated in was a meeting between women, and it was called, I guess it would be Meeting of Women Peace Builders. And there was participation from different countries in the region. Obviously, Colombia, Bolivia, Chile, Ecuador, Guatemala, Mexico, and Venezuela. And this was a meeting organized by the Verification Mission of United Nations in Colombia, also UN Women, and also the DPPA, which is the UN Program on Building National Capacities for Conflict Prevention. And all of the women that were there have some participation or leadership, you could say, in their countries in terms of what is necessary for peace building. So obviously there was a lot of moments where we were sharing with Colombian women at different levels, women who had been part of the peace agreements and that dialogue, but also different groups in different regions of the country. I was asked to speak about, in a panel, about security from a feminist perspective. And it was really interesting because I think there hasn't been that much discussion in terms of what security means for women and from a feminist perspective. When you look at what the resolutions on women, peace, and security from the United Nations state, most of the content of those resolutions are about how violence impacts women differently in conflicts, how women tend to be the majority of victims, and how sexual violence is used as a weapon of war in different conflicts, but also the need of women to participate in peace-building process, to be part of peace agreements or discussions, but also the need to protect women who are in context of conflict. But there hasn't really been enough about the security aspect. And there tends to be a reproduction of a notion of security from a state's point of view and a militarized point of view. Usually when the states talk about security, it's about police enforcement, it's about military enforcement, it's about defining the roles of those security institutions, also promoting the involvement of women, more women in the police, more women in the military. But when we start to discuss about from a feminist perspective, that's not necessarily what we are hoping for in terms of what security means to us, because in a lot of conflict context, these institutions are part of the problem or are part of implementing the violence or are not necessarily protecting in the best way. There's a lot of stereotypes sometimes. There tends to be in Latin America the notion that the civil population is conceived as an enemy, as a problem, and not necessarily from a democratic community point of view that protects women or the population in general. So there is a lot of questioning in terms of that's not really what security means to us. The panel was very interesting because these discussions came abroad, and there was a lot of criticism or questions about, like, even maybe not thinking about security in using the concept of security because of this baggage, you could say, in terms of this militarized notion of security, but thinking of other ways. And there's a lot of other aspects that are important when we think about what security means for women, and the notion of looking out for each other or taking care of each other, this notion of caring and protection from other mechanisms, more between women with other more localized community groups that can provide this the security, and how states need to recognize those ways of organizing and mechanisms for protection. So in the panel, I participated with other colleagues from Colombia, two colleagues who are part of the 1325 platform, and also from Mexico, speaking of more community-based experiences.
Thank you very much. Do you think that that concept of security from the militarized point of view has to do with the influence of the imperialist countries like United States and Canada? Because for those two countries, it is really a profitable business, because they participate in manufacturing war supplies.
Well, I think definitely for a lot of the states all over the world, the notion of when we think of security, the answer is a militarized or a way of confronting violence through arms. Definitely, war is a business for a lot of countries. And really what the Security Council does, it just regulates war. It doesn't really try to end wars or avoid wars. It tries to regulate so that the impacts to civil society is not great. But like I mentioned before, a lot of the solutions are not in terms of reforming or changing military institutions or police institutions, but the farthest it has gone is to include women in these institutions, or that some of these members need to understand, for example, that sexual violence is a crime or it cannot be committed during war. But there isn't really a profound or structural change in terms of these institutions that are also part of the problem. So definitely the Security Council is, like I said, it's more about regulating war. And I mean, there's some members in the Security Council that are permanent members that do not change. The other ones change constantly every 2 years. But for example, the United States, the United Kingdom, the Russian Federation, France, and China are permanent members of the Security Council. And these countries, as we know, are very much involved in war interventions or promoting war. A lot of the military industry of weapons and the weapon industry are from these countries as well. So there's definitely an interest there to keep these businesses. And there's a lot of money that is being made when there are wars. So obviously they are going to protect those business interests.
Yeah, I fully agree with you. Would you like to add anything else to our Canadian audience?
I want to say that One of the things I enjoyed about this meeting that I participated in was that we were able to meet women from different regions and different territories. There's a lot of, I'm impressed that there's a lot of strength and commitment of women to peace building. And I think it just sort of reaffirms the importance of women's participation in these processes. Usually during conflicts or after conflicts, women are the first to get involved in terms of trying to resolve the situations in their community levels. We've known, for example, in terms of in the Guatemalan context, for example, of disappeared, mostly men who disappeared, it was women who started looking for them. It has been women who have promoted this need for change. So in Colombia, I reaffirmed this leadership of women and how it is important to have their point of view in terms of what women need and what we need at the community levels to build peace. But one of the things I wanted to say is that we were able to meet with a group of women who are called Tamboreras del Cauca, which is, you could translate as drummers of the Cauca region. And these are women who are survivors of sexual violence and other crimes against humanity during the armed conflict. And they started to do work with arts and creative work as a process of healing what they had gone through. But what I liked is that they decided that they wanted to form some sort of music group. So they built their own drums, and now they create music, and they share like their experience of what they went through and what they suffered, but also of hope and change at their different communities. So I just wanted to share that, how there's so many different ways in which women contribute to peace building through different ways.
Oh, this sounds fascinating. Do you know if these Tamboreras del Cauca or drummers of the Cauca have any recordings? Because I think it would be great if we could give our listeners the opportunity to appreciate or to hear and listen this music.
No, they are in the process of recording some of their music, but I think maybe in some maybe YouTube, I think I saw some performances that maybe an extract from there could be heard.
Okay, thank you so much. We really appreciate your time and sharing with us your experience in the process of building peace in Guatemala, and also by participating in other countries. That is really amazing. Thank you so much.
Thank you again for inviting me.
Thank you, Brenda, for sharing your experiences with us. I fully agree with you in saying that it is important to include a feminist view to define the concept of security, and that not only the United States and Canada have economies that benefit from reproducing war materials, but there are also countries around the world with this interest. You also mentioned that having certain countries as permanent members of the Security Council is a problem because they are going to promote the economic interests of the production of war materials. That makes me think about war materials factories. And I would like you to share your opinion with us about this topic. During World War I, having men going to war, women served as ammunition testers and worked in every kind of factory devoted to the production of war materials, from the most dangerous posts in munition plants to the sewing in aeroplane factories. Although this situation gave women the opportunity to obtain jobs outside home, it also resulted in injured women without the proper compensation for their loss. During World War II, plants producing home appliances, automobiles, and toys were transformed to produce war materials. Do you think that now that we have seen all the impacts and effects wars had on women and the civilian population, factories in these countries should switch back to manufacture the products they were making previously, or perhaps manufacture products that have a greener economy?
Well, I think definitely in general, the production of weapons and the whole military industry should be reduced. There shouldn't be a need for like a mass production of weapons. Because on one hand, it also makes the weapons available not only to governments, but to other armed groups that might be interested in promoting war or violence. So I think that one of the aspects that also needs to be deeply looked into in these resolutions is the control of weapons, the production, who has access to them, but also what you were saying in terms of the production of weapons and how women and also children in some countries are exposed to injuries because they are cheap labor and they are usually contracted in these companies. So I think that also needs to be looked at and how that impacts the lives of women and children. And instead of these companies taking advantage of the poor living conditions and the need of money that these women or children might have, or their families and communities, we should try to think of businesses that contribute to the communities, that have some sort of contribution to making peace, but also to the economic growth and development of the communities. Certainly, I think it's been a while since World War I, and you would think that these companies should go back to manufacturing or making whatever it was that they were doing before the war. But obviously, they've seen that this gives them more income, more money. But I think people all over the countries and citizens of different countries can demand this better, more conscious production and more conscious businesses, as well as greener businesses. And I was just recently reading or hearing this comment that this girl, I think Greta is her name, I can't remember, that she says that we need to stop looking into, or we should stop expecting politicians to make changes in terms of ending war or a more greener or climate conscious policies, because their interest is in their own businesses. So I think as citizens of different countries, this is something that we should be pushing and demanding, that businesses contribute in some way and not produce weapons or anything that can damage the communities, the earth, and the lives of others.
Thank you very much, Brisna. So yes, in short, is that instead of these companies or factories that place profits above the interest of all, instead of choosing profits, we should choose the well-being of everyone or the majority in society. So I agree with you in that sense, and it is also up to us citizens of the world to push for these changes to happen and not to rely on, as you said, the politicians that really have an interest and economic interests to keep the society in a certain way. Thank you so much for your time and your experiences. It is a pleasure for us to have you here, and I don't know if you would like to add anything else.
I just want to thank you again for having me and being able to share some of my experiences and reflections on these issues.
Thank you and goodbye.
Welcome aboard. You are listening to Amandla on CKUT 90.3 FM. I'm inviting you on a ride across both the continent and my current hometown in the Cape. We're riding north along the main road towards the city center, thumbing through voice notes from correspondents for the conservation and biodiversity website Monga Bay. We'll begin in Cameroon with a note from Aminde Atabong about an oil palm company playing fast and loose with regulations in the country's southwest.
Agro-industrial company Cameroonvert SA, also known as Camvert, is again clearing forests near Kampoman National Park, raising questions over the allocation of its timber permits. At an October 26 press conference, conservation groups Greenpeace Africa, Green Development Advocates and Support Service for Grassroots Development Initiative said Camvert bulldozers have been clearing